From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's talk cybersecurity. As seen by someone who would probably know, 1.5 billion active users for Facebook every month, which is roughly the number of people in the world. It's not quite, but it feels like it. And you would think. And so let me bring in Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail, who has his finger on the pulse of so many things here in upstate New York. And our colleague Veronica Volk is here in studio as well. Matthew, what's going on this hour?
Well, Veronica had time to head out to RIT, as people in our newsroom often do, because Jennifer Henley, who is the Director of Security Operations at Facebook, was speaking there on campus last April. Veronica, so what was the audience that she was, who was she pitching to at the event?
Well, you have to keep in mind these are a bunch of RIT students, so she did get a little bit tech-speaky at times, but all around it was a really accessible presentation. You know, it's about the importance of security, which is such a big issue right now. It's on everyone's minds with, like we said, a billion and a half people on Facebook. And, you know, about the state of the industry. But before we get into that, a few things you should know about Henley. She got into tech because she was really into math and stats. She worked at eBay, PayPal, and now, of course, she's the director of security operations at Facebook. And to start off her presentation, she was talking about how much her job is changing and how important it's becoming.
Security has really gone mainstream. When I have my mom asking me questions about encryption, security has gone mainstream. This is such a unique industry. We change so frequently, and it's one of the things I love because I can go in daily and I don't know what I'm going to be dealing with. We have nation-state attacks, APT, surveillance. We have to deal with breaches and vulnerabilities and, you know, sometimes good people who just make mistakes. This is what we are faced with as an industry. We have to be reactive, and we have to be proactive. We have to try to stay one step ahead, but also sometimes be okay that we're not. And how do we respond effectively? We have to balance and manage risk. Where are we spending our money? Where are we putting our time? Where are we investing people? And through all of that, what's becoming more and more important is we can't just focus on our own products or our own company or our own, you know, desires for what we're trying to do. We have to look at the internet as a whole because it's growing and expanding unlike anything that I think any of us could have imagined. And that's what we need to focus on. How do we make the internet safe and secure? And what role do we play in that?
So she kind of sets up this idea that working in cybersecurity makes you this protector of the internet. And I thought that from there she was going to start talking about like encryption and malware and spies, or I don't really know what I thought she was going to talk about.
It was going to be a technical solution.
Exactly, yeah. But that's not where she went with it at all. Actually, some of the security drills they run at Facebook are super low tech. So this next bit, it's kind of long, but she's talking about the games that they play at Facebook to bring up awareness about cybersecurity importance. Because if you think about it, if Facebook gets hacked, we all get hacked, right? So for me, this is kind of a cool insight into the inner workings of the company. And of course, they go about this in the most Facebook internet company outside the box way possible.
So hopefully most of you have heard about National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, which is every year in October. And the goal that each and every one of us needs to do our part to stay safe and secure online. So they always encourage people to stop, think, connect before you're taking actions online. So we started talking about this 4 years ago because we said, how do we get people to care? Okay? Because one of the things we learn in security is that most often people don't care until there's an issue. Until something has gone wrong, security is something that's done in the background, it's there, it happens, or it's a hurdle. It's something they don't want to think about. And that's where we came up with this idea of Hacktober. So October, Hacktober. We had four very simple goals. We wanted to get our employees talking about security. We wanted something that we could scale so that all of our global offices could engage. We wanted to try and make awareness fun. And we wanted to try and demonstrate the importance of security through empathy. by trying to understand what people feel on a day-to-day basis going through their jobs and what they see. And that's where we came up with Hacktober. So I'm going to walk you through a couple of the things we do. And you're probably going to be thinking as I'm going through this that I am evil and my coworkers are evil and we are tormenting people. But again, our goal with all of this is we want people to care about security and understand how it impacts them. So we sent an email with a malicious attachment from an unknown sender. And we targeted it based on what group and what teams people were in. Recruiters got resumes, finance got POs to approve, some people got stock grants to accept. We targeted it based on what team people were on. But what's important when you do this is it's not about making people a victim. It's not about shaming people. It's about teaching people, how do you respond if this happens? And it was funny because a lot of people came back to us and said, oh, come at us harder. That's actually pretty easy. You're right, it is easy. And that's why it's the number one attack vector that hits most companies. Most companies get breached because of phishing emails or because of attachments that seem to be very normal that you're just going about your day-to-day business. So what do we do with this? We don't have a wall of sheep where we're calling out the people, oh, you fell for this, you're stupid. It's going in your performance review. We actually did the opposite. We told people, self-report. Let us know if you fell for it. What was it about it that made you think it was okay to click? And we encouraged them to post in an open Facebook group. And they did. And you know what? We were shocked. Like, people were self-reporting this. And then there were people who were commenting to let us know, hey, I just got this email and I don't actually think this is, something seems off about it. So what do? We actually rewarded people for self-reporting to us. Because we want to break down that culture and that notion that security is scary and you only engage with the security team when something bad happens. We want them to feel comfortable asking us questions and talking about these things. And if there is one thing, it doesn't matter where you are, how old you are, what it is, people will go bananas for free stuff. So we had stickers, we had posters, we had t-shirts that we would give out to people who engaged in this discussion. And then through all of this, what we do afterwards is we talk them through, what should you do? Where should you report this if you get one of these that you think is suspicious? If you do open one, it's fine. Let us know. Let us know sooner rather than later. This is how you report it. This is who you can talk to. And we got people engaged in a dialogue about this. We placed mysterious USB drives with malicious executables around the offices. This is, again, a thing that's really easy to do in global offices. You send a box of them and find somebody there who you can say, hey, we're sending you this. We'll give you something for it. Can you drop them around the office? So what we know is if you put confidential on something, people are going to open it. Curiosity killed the cat. And what we also found is this was even more impactful in offices where we had people who were constantly moving, sales offices, advertising offices. You know, whether it's CDs or USBs, they're used to taking those and sticking them in and out of computers. So it was just another reminder to people to think before you act. And hey, maybe you found this, take it to our help desk, have them look at it before you just put it in your computer. And what we did with this one that I thought was really, really cool is if you open this and put it in, it actually popped up a page and the Ghostbusters theme song played and our Hacktober pumpkin came up and told you you've been hacked. So what happened with this? We actually saw that people were more vigilant. They were raising issues that weren't even part of Hacktober. We saw a 35% increase in people who participated in our security discussion group. We started to see people who weren't even on the security team answering security questions. And they were right. That's fantastic. We have over 10,000 employees. We have just over 100 people on our security team right now. We can't be everywhere. and we saw proactive engagement. And this lasted throughout the entire year. It wasn't just in October. And most important for us is we saw people actually retained and remembered that information. This is going to be our fifth year this year. We actually have people now who in July and August will start Hacktober countdowns because they're excited for the year to come. And you know the other thing we've done with this? Last year we upped it. We said, we're going to come after you, but you guys come after us as well. And they took us up on it. And it's good because we need to be tested just as much. We took away the fear factor associated with security. We showed people how these incidents can actually impact them and what it's like on a day-to-day basis. There was a sense of camaraderie that formed. It was funny, one of the emails was this fake resume from this fake candidate named Eric Greenlee. And somebody internally started a Facebook group that was 1 million strong against Eric Greenlee. Eric Greenlee somehow sends an email every year during Hacktober now. But there was a bond that formed from people because they realized this can happen to anyone and what do we need to do? But most importantly, they became more aware of security-related issues.
That's the voice of Jennifer Henley. She's the Director of Security Operations at Facebook, and we're hearing parts of her address that she gave to RIT last month. With me in the studio, Veronica Volk, who's one of our reporters here at WXXI. I'm Matthew Leonard from the Innovation Trail, and it's Innovation Friday. Thanks for being with us. So, Veronica, yeah, we're hearing a couple of different some kind of things about the human vulnerabilities, right, in this whole process of how all you have to do is mark a folder confidential and you can guarantee someone will open it, even, no matter what's in there, right?
Right, and even around here, I feel like Hacktober is the kind of thing we could do right here. Drop some compromised SD cards around the radio offices here at WXXI.
That's right. People are so hungry for those bits of media, they'll probably pick them up. So her point is just that a lot of this is about behavior, you know, so yeah, that was interesting. And that you were saying while the sound was playing too, that people see Facebook itself and the staff at Facebook as potential kind of targets for compromising cybersecurity. Right,
and that responsibility for your security really also extends to the users of Facebook, which is another thing that she touched on. So to that end, she had some tips, like how to keep your information in your account safe, because you know, a lot of people look at Facebook as being the protector, and they look at the people who work at Facebook as being responsible for that. And she says, of course, they take that very seriously, but you know, we have to make an effort too.
How many people in this room have login approvals turned on their Facebook account? Every single hand in this audience should raise. If there are two things, I always get asked this question, what are the two, you know, what is the one or two things? Here's the two pieces of advice I can give you. Anywhere and everywhere you can turn on a second factor of authentication, you should do it. And that's what login approvals are. Login approvals is a way that you sign up for it. The first time you log in from a new device that isn't recognized, they're going to send you, it's a 6-digit code we'll send you to your phone. All you have to do is put it in, it validates that it's you, and then we'll ask you, would you like us to remember this device going forward? You can click yes or no, and then it's remembered, and you'll never be prompted for it again. Unless you hit no, then you'll be prompted for it again. Maybe that's something that's a little too time intensive for you. Consider login notifications. Now, if login approvals is a proactive side, for some people, login notifications is a reactive. It's not going to stop or prevent somebody from getting into your account, but it's actually going to notify you if it's from a device that isn't recognized or somewhere that you're not aware you've logged in before. If there is one thing you take away from this talk today, please, please, please turn on login approvals on your account. And the other thing, in case you're wondering what the second piece of advice is, make sure you use different passwords on different sites.
Yeah, she's pretty adamant about that, which I get, it's her whole job. But then she kind of moves away from the specifics and she started talking about the industry as a whole, which I found really interesting. She pointed out some of the inherent weaknesses of tech in general and, you know, the cybersecurity field. And during this, you know, it wasn't lost on me that she and I are two of a handful of women in this group of over 100 RIT students. And she starts off this conversation about diversity in the cybersecurity industry by introducing ideas about empathy.
Security is becoming less tunnel focused on strictly technology, but how we blend that with the human side. It's more about people, understanding their behaviors, how they respond, how they react, what engages them. We need to start focusing on changing the game and changing our image by looking at the human factor of what we do. And we have to do that by understanding people. So I'm going to ask you all to just humor me for a second. And I want you to close your eyes for a second, and I want you to picture in your head what you think of when you think of a security engineer or a security professional. So everybody close your eyes. If you pictured a man, I want you to raise your hand. It's okay. All right. You know what? That's pretty normal. Let's talk about security. We have a brand problem and we have an image problem. I was at an all-women's conference last month and I did a similar exercise and asked people, all women, 90% of the room raised their hand that they pictured a man. These are women who are in security. 90%. When you ask people who they think a security engineer is, I guarantee you most of the time they're going to think of a man, okay? Because that's what the images are, and that's what we see, that's what's out there. But here's the other thing. This is what else they think about. They think about the attacker. They think about the person sitting in his or her parents' basement with a hood, away on their computer, not talking to anybody else. They think about anonymous. And in the rare time that people do think of females, it's normally A, because you are a female and you're interested in security, or you picture one of those very quirky characters who has been made popular by shows like NCIS or CSI, where they're locked off in a room, not talking, not with the rest of the team. Don't bother me unless I come talk to you. I'm in security, I'll tell you what's going on. And don't even get me started on the misconceptions that go on about having two people on the keyboard at the same time. That's what people see. That's what they think. That's what they imagine when they think of the security space. Most people don't think about the protectors and the defenders. Understanding behaviors and protecting people as they do their work and live their lives. That's the side of security I want people to start to think about and see. There was a study that was done in 2013 in InfoSec magazine, and they asked men and women in the security profession or people who had left the profession or were thinking about going into the profession, why do people not go into security? Why are people not interested in security? These were the six common themes that came up in responses. Security is not a glamorous job and it's not interesting. It's an unattractive field that is more based on isolated work than collaborative work. It's a risk-based discipline, so it's not as creative. Okay, let me just tell you, as somebody who's been in the security space for over a decade now, that could not be farther from the truth. We are putting more and more of our lives online. And in return, we get to use products and services that make our lives easier and better, allow us to connect with people in ways that we never knew were possible. It's an amazing power we have. And there's a huge spotlight on security because of that. But you know what else that does? It makes it really easy for the bad people who are out there who want to exploit that. And there's a lot more opportunities for them. Do you know in 2014, there was a 46% increase in breaches reported? 46%. And 60% of companies who reported being breached said they were hit at least twice. So if you're popped, there's a 50-50 chance that you're going to get popped again. We saw some massive attacks. You think about what we saw with Sony. We saw a company that lost IP. They lost personal data. They lost employee information. They lost money. I mean, you talk about the whole spectrum of what normally comes on a breach. Normally, it's one area or another. I mean, this was a company that was basically, their entire network was useless. This was massive. So I would like anyone to tell me that this is not a glamorous field right now and there's not interest in it. Oh my goodness, it's wide open. There is so much work to be done. And we need creative solutions to do that. Because I said earlier, we have to try and stay a step ahead. We can't rely on what we've always done. Nothing makes me happier to know that there are programs out there like this that exist that are getting people excited and interested in security. Because if you had asked me about what security was, or even now when people ask me sometimes, they ask me if I ride a Segway or carry a taser. Security is starting to go mainstream. And as much as sometimes the storylines in CSI Cyber drive me absolutely crazy, I'm glad people are talking about it. I'm glad people are looking at it. And if you ever want to do something fun and you guys are thinking about it, there's some great CSI Cyber bingo games that you can play. You guys are the ones who are going to have to build these elegant solutions to combat these challenges we're facing. And when we talk about collaboration, and trust me, I know collaboration, it can slow us down. We have to work with another team. We have to talk with other people. Trust me, I'm a people person, and sometimes I'm like, God, just let me work. But you know what? We need to go in that direction. Because I'll tell you what, the attackers have been doing it for a long time, and there's a reason they're steps ahead of us. We need to get better at that. Because when we look at the state of the industry, and we need to protect the internet, which is a global entity, it cannot just be protected by white men. And that's what 78% of our industry is made up of right now. 10% females, 5% Latinos, 7% African American. I find these numbers abysmal, and I hope you do too, because we all play a role in this. We have to be deliberate. We have to be intentional when we talk about this, because this is what I will tell you. Diverse groups of people solve problems better. Diverse groups of people are shown to solve problems faster, on time, under budget, and with greater creativity. And you want to know why? It's because we don't all think the same. We don't all come from the same background. But neither are the people who are using our services. We have to think beyond just ourselves. And a great way to do that is to collaborate with people who aren't just like you.
So this resonated with me a lot, of course, because like I said, she and I are two of the only women in this room, and I'm not even in tech. So she was really adamant about this point.
Right, sure. And she's really clearly getting very passionate about the need for diversity. And this is something that's come up in a lot of conversations just around corporate culture, for example, meeting culture of meetings, problem solving, that kind of thing. So it was interesting to hear that she's, obviously, here she is in obviously a pretty powerful position in this sort of behemoth that is Facebook, but still acknowledging the huge kind of gaps. So we should say to people too that there are definitely positive initiatives out there. There's groups like Girls Who Code, Black Girls Code, initiatives that are really, really targeting the diversity issues, at least on the gender and some of the racial areas, to try and get more people engaged in the kinds of things that Henley's talking about. So we're just about done. This has been Jennifer Henley, Director of Security security operations at Facebook. Veronica Volk is with me here on Innovation Friday with Evan Dawson. And what does Henley kind of take us out with?
This is just a close. She has a call to action. You have to remember that her audience is a group of RIT students who are probably going to be thinking about going into the field at some point. And she wants to steer them towards cybersecurity. And she kind of gives her reasons why.
We must have empathy. The ability to understand other people's feelings, share other people's feelings. And maybe you're better at it at one than the other, and that's fine. But empathy is what needs to drive the problems we're solving and help us determine how to apply those solutions. Empathy is what's going to allow us to solve and tackle these complex problems and challenges that are in front of all of us. To look at people and making the world better versus just doing things because we can. You are all incredibly smart individuals. I have no doubt you're here. And there are probably a lot of things you can do just because you can. Think beyond that. What do you need to do? What technology can you invent? You are the future of this space. You are the people who are going to be famous in security someday. What are you going to do to change this? How are you going to think beyond yourself, beyond your own personal gains, but to the world as a whole and the internet as a whole and how to make that better? Protection is at the core of what we do. Most of us. You can go to DEF CON and you can see some other sides of that. But for most of us who are drawn to this space, it's protection. It's defense. We want to protect employees. We want to protect students. We want to protect people living their lives online. And in some cases, we want to protect lives. That's what we're doing. That's what security is all about. And when I think about the state of our workforce, and I think at how we need to look at this diverse and broad group of people, we have a problem. You all can help fix that.
So I'm obviously not Henley's target audience, right? And I admit at times it sort of felt like I was in an ad for Facebook security. But overall, her points about, you know, first of all, the relevance of cybersecurity right now, especially with more and more of our lives online and the lack of diversity in the industry, you know, more importantly, making a conscious effort to change that and how much, you know, it can help the industry grow and evolve and really meet the needs that that the public has. And I think that they're good pieces to take away from this and also turn on login approvals.
Right, sure. Take it and use two different, don't use the same password across all of your sites. Right, that was the second thing. Thanks, Veronica, for sharing that. I mean, it was interesting just to have an insight into the kind of thinking at that level in Facebook as well, outside of the kind of, I mean, it still gives you a sense of the corporate culture, but also given that those entities touch so many areas of people's lives, even if you think you're kind of at a distance, you know, you're firewalled from it, you're not. So it was pretty interesting to hear her get kind of fired up and passionate about that. It's Innovation Friday. Still to come, we're going to look at a new nationwide survey of people in the rental market. Why should we care about what people in the rental market think? You'll find out after this short break on Innovation Friday.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we talk to music industry legend Herb Alpert. He's coming to Rochester to perform at the Xerox Rochester International Jazz Festival. We'll get his take on 6 decades in the industry. Then we honor Memorial Day with special programming. Hope you'll join us Monday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from City Blue Imaging, a commercial printer based in downtown Rochester for more than 85 years, specializing in digital color printing, trade show, and special event printing. CityBlueImaging.com.
It's Innovation Friday. I'm Matthew Leonard, editor of the Innovation Trail. InnovationTrail.org is where you can go to catch up on some of the stories we've been talking about. And with me, of course, Evan Dawson.
Hello there.
Evan, so I don't know if there was an NPR report this week just about the how the rate of inflation had far the rental market had actually cost of renting had actually outstripped inflation, and that people, you know, this is actually a 20-year high in the rental market. Basically, this got us thinking about some of the economics of renting, and particularly thanks to some new survey done by Apartment List, a database of apartment listings. We're going to look at what the rental market can tell us about the future of cities and communities, and why we should care about the opinions of people who rent. And to help us navigate that, Andrew Tam is the Vice President of Data Science at Apartment List. Andrew, thanks very much. You're in the Bay Area, I understand.
Yep, we are. Pleasure to be on the show.
Thanks for being with us. So tell us about this is a national survey. So just tell us about what Apartment List does. What business are you guys in?
Yeah, so Apartment List is one of the largest online rental marketplaces, helping to connect people looking for a place to rent with landlords who are looking to rent out their places. And so, as you mentioned, with Americans renting at the highest rate of the past 20 to 25 years, according to the census, really driven by the Great Recession of 2007 and 2009, driving home ownership rates down. We are really helping Americans to find a place to call home.
Right. Yeah. So there's been huge kind of disruptions in the market. You referred to the census, the U.S. Census does, as in addition to doing the formal census, they also do a yearly update where they kind of look at these kinds of figures and provide a sort of snapshot of the nation. So why, your database is trying to link landlords and properties with people in the market for rental properties. What sort of questions were you interested in the process of this national survey? So how many people did you survey, and what were the questions that you asked them?
Sure. So we managed to reach over 18,000 total respondents for our survey nationwide. And as we looked at the overall kind of national media discourse, there's so much attention that's just focused on homeowners and not a lot of attention focused on renters and what they care about. And so the goal of the survey was really to understand, you know, renters being a large growing demographic, they're also a highly mobile demographic, meaning they move 4 to 5 times as often as a homeowner. What do they care about the most when they choose a place to live, when they choose a city or a neighborhood? So our survey covered 3 basic sections. One was about city satisfaction, both their overall satisfaction levels and the different components of satisfaction or different metrics that drive that overall satisfaction. The second was their plans for future homeownership. So are people planning to buy it again? You know, is there a swing back in the pendulum, back towards homeownership? And then the third bit was just about confidence in the economy. So how are all these different factors related to a renter's confidence in both the national and the local economy?
And Rochester did not do well.
Rochester did not do well on a number of different factors. So interestingly, Rochester scored very, very highly on future plans for homeownership. So a lot of renters who are in the Rochester area do plan to own, and they actually graded out at an A+, which ranked them actually 4th in the nation overall. But in just general city satisfaction, they scored below average. So they got a C- grade. And 2 factors that we found that correlate very strongly to that grade are confidence in the local economy and satisfaction with safety and crime rates. And in those 2 metrics, the renters in Rochester graded a C plus for confidence in the local economy, and actually an F for satisfaction with safety and crime rates. And so, you know, we just don't see very high city satisfaction rates without those 2 metrics being a little bit stronger.
So what was the window? What was the window of the survey? It was a 3-month survey. And when was it taken?
From October to December 2014.
Okay. So that's interesting. We'll kind of mull over what local factors there might have been at that time, too, in terms of shaping some of those sorts of opinions. But let's just go back and talk about this mobility issue of renters, people who rent. Why is that? What does that tell us, or why is that valuable that you're getting these sort of a sense of the sentiment or confidence levels of people who are actually moving a lot? I assume, I mean, one thing is that people if they're moving a lot, I guess, have more points of comparison. They may be moving between different rental markets, different metropolitan or rural areas.
Yeah, the idea is that they, on average, move every 2 years, whereas the homeowners generally move every 9 or 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so in that move, they have more choices. They have more ability to say, hey, look, you know, I can make a move. I'm not tied down from a capital perspective to this particular neighborhood or city. And so if there's a better job opportunity, if Buffalo is doing a little bit better, then I can move there. And so as the city tries to grow its tax base and tries to build thriving local communities, they want to position themselves to be as attractive as possible. And what the study was hoping to do was just elicit what elements of city life drive that attractiveness.
Right. So they're kind of they're sort of an indicator or a sort of a canary in the coal mine for livability on certain levels. And I think you're right that definitely home ownership's been something that people have looked at pretty closely, but less so the kind of momentum around people who rent and how they might drive economies.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So what else? Let's invert it and look at what cities. Why should cities be concerned about what renters think?
Well, so
you know, based on that mobility. You know, if they're mobile, they don't like it. Okay, well, we don't like Rochester or Buffalo. We can just up. You know, we can give notice and move somewhere else.
Sure. Yeah, and just as we talked about those first two themes, right? So. In 2008, the homeownership level or the renter level was in the 20% range, and now we're in 36. Now we're up at 36%. So you're talking about just a very large and growing demographic. And then with the mobility factor, right? These cities are basically jockeying for position around who can attract, you know, the largest tax base. Renters also tend to be younger. So we're talking about the millennial generation. We're talking about people coming out of college, et cetera. And so where are we going to see population growth and where are we going to see long-term community building?
We're talking to Andrew Tam, Vice President of Data Science of Apartment List, who is talking to us about the research that they've conducted in Rochester not getting very good marks in some regards for renters. Remind us again, Andrew, which cities do very, very well with this? What are the kind of cities that do attract millennials, people who want to rent?
You know, it's interesting. We and the AP just published a story on this based on our data as well. We actually see that you know, large and actually relatively expensive cities do quite well. And so in our top 10 are you know, cities like Boston, Austin, Texas, Washington, D.C., and some smaller ones like Grand Rapids, Michigan, also scored in the top 10. And so we actually see that there's a combination typically of a strong local economy, so a lot of great job and career prospects, you know, a good safe environment, so people, you know, aren't feeling like they're putting themselves or their families in danger. And then the third most important factor that we found, which actually surprised us a little bit, was access to recreational opportunities, and that would be stuff like parks, museums, restaurants, you know, kind of like a thriving kind of urban environment. And so what we saw was that even cities that were extremely expensive, so those would be cities like San Francisco, Washington, D.C., New York, despite their high cost of living, people report extremely high satisfaction. And so, you know, we know we happen to be here in San Francisco, so there's something like, you know, an influx of about 200,000 people over the past 10 years. Into this city here. So rents, cost of homeownership, et cetera, have all gone through the roof, but that just hasn't deterred people from still coming because of the thriving tech economy, as well as kind of the amazing access to outdoors with, call it Lake Tahoe, wine country, Yosemite, et cetera.
You mentioned security or safety as an issue that Rochester did very poorly. In fact, scored an F, you said, right?
Correct.
Okay, and to be clear, that's not looking at actual metrics of crime. That is a renter survey on how they feel about safety, yes?
Correct.
Yeah, so I'm certainly not at all questioning the validity of this kind of study. I'm more just trying to parse in my own mind, October to December of 2014, right on the heels of probably the highest profile single episode of violence in the city in maybe 40 years. The only shooting death of a Rochester police officer in four decades happened weeks before the survey began, so that might have been top of mind. But I also think of this city as one where, you know, Matthew Leonard, correct me if I'm wrong here, but especially compared to some upstate cities, Rochester has pockets of the city with concentrated poverty, some of the most concentrated poverty in the country for a city of its size, and certainly areas of joblessness and violence. But there are also districts and neighborhoods that are doing very, very well, and that's where a lot of millennials do rent. And so it's I find it interesting to see an F. I guess I would understand something B, C, D. F is, to me, a bit of a surprise. You?
Well, and I guess it depends on the point. I think, yeah, obviously as a kind of point of sense that you're not, Andrew Tame, you're not claiming, you know, that there's anything other than people's sort of perceptions and sentiment in response to questions.
Which
about
matters.
What are your, yeah. And
which really matters.
Right. And often and often that can be based on a different sense of the community than people who are homeowners or who've been here long. I mean, renters by definition would tend to be people who, if they're moving every 2 years, maybe don't have such a strong sense of the, don't take as long a view of the community, perhaps, Andrew.
Yeah, that's correct. And again, you hit the nail on the head. This is a survey, and the question that was asked was, how satisfied are you with safety and crime rates in your area? From very dissatisfied all the way up to very satisfied.
Right.
And so what we saw nationwide was that 53% of people on average expressed satisfaction. And in Rochester, it was 33%. So it was one out of three.
Yeah.
But again, you know, this is dealing with perception. So, a follow-up study that we are considering doing is actually marrying up these scores with, you know, FBI crime rate data and, you know, what ought to be kind of objective metrics and just actually taking a lens to where is there the biggest gap, right?
Yeah.
Like where do people not feel safe even though it is safe?
And trying
to highlight, you know, what might be going on there.
Yeah. And I mean, I think maybe the takeaway for community-minded people, civic leaders, people in that kind of frame of mind is actually the question of perception. That often it's not always the reality. It can sometimes be the perception. And that's something that obviously drives some huge economic engines. I mean, perception and sentiment have a huge role in the capital, you know, the capital market generally. But so in terms of cities, obviously, you know, with some vested interest, you are certainly encouraging policymakers and business leaders to sort of be more mindful of this particular demographic, right?
That's correct. And we wanted to set up the data in a way that there would be something actionable to do. One of the things that we didn't ask about, which maybe we could have asked about, was like, you know, how satisfied are you with the weather, right? Because people in Florida and Southern California generally move to those areas because of the weather. But that wasn't anything that a policymaker could do. That wasn't we could do with, right? There's nothing that a business leader or a community leader could do with that information. You can't change the weather in Rochester. So our idea was if we could isolate a couple of discrete factors, and those in our study were, the local economy, safety, access to recreation, quality of local schools, commute times, and state and local taxes. We felt like those were a pretty good set of criteria and metrics for community and business leaders to look at, that we would be able to come back and say, hey, what we actually find is that people are really focused on the local economy, they're focused on safety, they're focused on access to recreation, and those are things that, you know, local leaders can do something about and can have an influence on.
Right. And Rochester, yeah, and the city actually got a B in access to recreational activities, comes as no surprise, and the satisfaction with daily commute also a B. So let's look at this plans for home ownership and what you think that, you know, what takeaways there might be from that, do you think, in terms of clearly there's, does that mean that that doesn't necessarily, that just means they intend to buy a home anywhere. It doesn't mean they're necessarily,
not necessarily
buy a home
here
in the city they're renting in.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Correct.
Sure.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an indicator of aspiration because we're getting all these sort of different mixed signals around millennials. You know, they want to live in caffeinated districts. They don't want to run a car. They want to be able to walk to work, you know, all that kind of stuff. But there's at least in the figures that you've gleaned for Rochester, there's a pretty heavy signal that people are interested in getting a mortgage.
Yeah. So, well, again, we saw nationwide on average 60% of renters indicating they plan to buy a home in the future. And in Rochester, it was 76%. So that's a material outperformance, and that's what drives, you know, an A-plus rating. But to your point, we did not ask if they also plan to buy in that same, you know, city or metropolitan area. It's just that those respondents from Rochester plan to buy a home in the future.
Well, there's definitely a trend with people, you know, millennials moving to places like the west side of Buffalo because of just very, very low house prices, you know, sort of. And so perhaps I think getting out of, you know, when we're seeing those kind of populations who are moving out of, you know, areas like Brooklyn or, you know, the five boroughs where there's very, very high, you know, rents and housing prices are climbing exponentially, they maybe get a different sense of possibility when they move into, you know, into regional, you know, regional areas or other parts of the country.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, in terms of, do you think that, did you get a sense of whether homeowners or renters kind of, so you mentioned places with growing population, which was also part of the kind of census data, you know, you mentioned places like Austin, which is, you know, continues to kind of be an incredibly rapidly growing city, Austin, Texas. What could you just give us a sense of what you learned from some of the other cities? I mean, did renters or homeowners kind of drive that growth? You know, when a city like Austin is growing, are they a part of the growth, or is it, do you see it in home ownership first?
So we really just focus on renters. So we didn't poll homeowners. So I can't speak to that in particular. I think the themes that we saw were, again, just these cities that are doing really well economically and that have these, you know, great safe environments and that have also a great kind of recreational life seem to perform extremely well. The other thing we did see, you know, one of the cuts that we did do was just a cut between people who have kids versus people who don't have kids. And what we absolutely saw there was just a huge importance placed on the quality of local schools. So when we looked at just respondents with kids as their own population, quality of local schools became basically tied with economy for being a great predictor for overall city satisfaction. The other thing that we looked at was people who are married versus unmarried. And so there's, you know, a huge population of renters who are unmarried. But people who are married have much higher plans for home ownership. So, again, you don't find that particularly surprising. But, you know, there's generally been a good deal of consternation in the national media about whether or not millennials plan to buy and why they're opting out of the home ownership economy for so long. And I think one of the things that we see, which supports research from other economists nationwide, is that things are actually tied a little bit more to lifestyle, life catalysts. So when you get married, that's when you actually get real serious about buying a home. And millennials are not opting out of home ownership, but they are delaying marriage. Mm-hmm. And so in that delay of marriage, you also see kind of a longer renter cycle for them.
Right.
So those were a couple of the other things that we found that we either corroborated what we saw from other places, as well as were a little bit surprised.
Right. People who are renting properties, what do you think they would take away from some of the work, some of the results of the survey? Maybe just talking more nationally now.
Sure. I think it gets back to, you know, one of the big takeaways that we looked into with the Associated Press is just for renting can be a lifestyle choice, right? And so people, they're coming out of college, they're a little bit earlier in their lives and their careers, and they say, you know, I'm willing to, you know, pay exorbitant rent to go live in a place that's really exciting. Maybe it's good for my career, maybe it's great for my social life, you know, maybe it's a fun place to be. And I think this also ties in with the idea of getting married a little bit later in life. So if you want to enjoy those early years, you tend to gravitate to a place that's really exciting. And so I think that's why we actually ended up seeing places like, you know, again, Boston, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., New York, Denver, San Diego. They're very expensive markets. They're basically in our top 10 of most expensive rental markets nationwide, but they're all scoring A's and A-pluses. And so I think that's absolutely part of what's driving some of this response.
Isn't that interesting that some of the highest scoring and the most expensive, and it's the other metrics that really has attracted renters because there's a lot of talk around here in Rochester about getting a lot for your money, but that's obviously not everything. Some final thoughts as we begin to wrap up with Andrew Tam, the VP of Data Science at Apartment List. If you missed part of the earlier conversation, the rental rate in this country has gone up, particularly since the economic downturn of 2007, 8, and 9. Fair to say, Andrew?
Correct.
And for those who see the Dow and they see the market ostensibly bouncing back, they might think, well, we've got to be getting back to homeownership levels, but we're not.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, we are seeing people a little bit reluctant to get back into the market. Common narrative that's out there is that millennials saw the downside of homeownership, and so they're, you know, perhaps emotionally scarred and realize that they don't want to get themselves into a bad credit situation. In addition to seeing the stock market bounce back, we also have credit at all-time low rates, right? So there's access to credit is very easy. And yet, first-time home buyers are down near in the low 30% of all home sales, where in the historically they've averaged 40%. And so you see this dichotomy or this disconnect between the credit markets and what people expect to see out of first-time home buyers and millennials. And I think some of that is more driven by kind of lifestyle choices and life catalysts than it is an actual complete opt-out of the homeownership market.
Mm-hmm. Links to the survey information we've been talking about are at innovationtrail.org and at wxxinews.org. And I'd encourage you, yeah, if you've got any sort of interest in this data at all, I definitely encourage you to go and have a look at the national survey information. It does give you a kind of really interesting sense of how people are moving and what kinds of sentiment this particular part of our community have. Over, as you said, Andrew, I think 36% of Americans are in the rental market. So they're a significant kind of bellwether for a whole lot of interesting issues and ideas. Thanks very much for being with us, Andrew Tam, Vice President of Data for Apartment List. That's Innovation Friday for another month. Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
And Matthew Leonard, as always, great work. InnovationTrail.org for the work that you and the team of Innovation Trail reporters are doing on a regular basis. I hope that we'll all be able to enjoy the weather. And then we honor Memorial Day here at WXXI on Monday. You'll hear an hour of programming on Connections and then special programming for Memorial Day. I'll be back talking to you live on Tuesday. And I know, Matthew, we'll see you and the Innovation Trail team next week as well, as we always do.
Yeah, you will. Next month it'll be, hopefully.
That'll be better,
if that's okay.
Or every day at innovationtrail.org. John Anders, thanks for the work as our engineer today. I'm Evan Dawson. Thank you for listening to member-supported public radio.